Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 176, Science Faction, the Cambrian period.
176 episodes of you saying hello like Mrs. Doubtfire would. This has been a magical...
First of all, I did it first. Robin Williams bit off me.
And Harvey Firestein stole his entire bit from me.
Yeah, that is actually true. I've read that before. The Cambrian period, you may have heard a lot about this just in passing. You've probably heard the term Precambrian or Cambrian explosion. All of that refers to this one period. By the way, we are finally solidly into the periods now. We're out of the eras because we're in a place where the period makes a better distinction of time. This is the first period of the Paleozoic era, and the Cambrian lasts from about 541 million years ago to about 485 million years ago. So you'll know, also, we're drastically reducing the spans of time that we're talking about, and that's because this is when stuff starts getting really interesting. This marked a profound change in life on Earth. Prior to the Cambrian, the majority of living organisms were small, unicellular, and simple, though there were some multicellular life and there were eukaryotes around. In the Cambrian, this is when we start seeing complex multicellular organisms becoming more and more common. We saw it start happening just before the Cambrian, but that really happens in the Cambrian with the Cambrian explosion. And we see a lot of the different animal types that basically led to the animals that we know now. Now is when looking at the creatures living on Earth, we would start recognizing things that have some kind of form similar to those that we would recognize in modern day animals. Again, this is one of those things where had this happened slightly differently, had certain animals died or survived in different ways, we would have a very different looking biosphere on Earth right now.
What type of archaeologist studies these animals?
No archaeologist would study these animals because archaeologists study people. Some paleontologists would study this kind of stuff, especially ones who look at microfossils, but also, like we talked about, some of the larger fossils. There used to be a thought when we would see this explosion of animals in the Cambrian explosion, there was this thought like, oh man, this must be really the origin of life. That was one of the really old thoughts. We later found out that no, origin of life predates this by literally billions of years. This is just when we start seeing these large type fossils that are easier to find. As we do more and more paleontological research, especially into the small stuff, we find that there is still really interesting stuff before the Cambrian period, but this is when we see the explosion of large things that we would really recognize today as fossils. It set the stage for the entire way that we see the biosphere of Earth today, from the animals to the plants to the fish. Everything comes out of this period.
So this is my personal prequel, or this is like my
it kind of is.
Story.
Yeah, this is like Star Wars Episode -1.
So if we were to make a movie about my life, the first 30 minutes would be dedicated to everything during this period.
It should be. Yeah, I think that's how they did adaptation.
Or in other words, this is the time on a Friday or Saturday night around 10 o'clock when the bar starts getting really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
People got their buzz on.
The Cambrian explosion of beer goggles. And speaking of beer goggles, I am your host, comedian and archaeologist, Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how you doing today?
Doing great. As a product of beer goggles, I got nothing but kind things to say.
That is absolutely true. A product and frequent user. You're not just the president, you're also a client.
I'm like Bob Dole with Viagra.
Yeah, and also your arm doesn't work well for completely other reasons. And of course, our science expert for the evening, Naomi. Naomi, how you doing?
Well, with my beer goggles on, you guys are looking pretty good.
So. Yeah. You'd really need more of a beer telescope for Damian, but even then. And we are broadcasting this from the Madhouse Comedy Club along the skyline of beautiful downtown San Diego. Come on out and check out Madhouse's Saturday Night lineup. And when you're not doing that, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to. And that still controversial Mastodon blog that is still getting me in trouble and we're getting a lot of interesting emails about. So if you'd like to go see what all that buzz is about, go ahead and check out our website, www.thesciencefaction.com.
You're building your entire career about being incendiary about this Cerruti article.
That's true. I think Bill O'Reilly built his entire career out of getting like knocked out by some tennis star back in the day. I'm going to be the next Bill O'Reilly.
Off to a good start.
All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, super interesting article came across the news sites this week, and it speaks to something broader than just what the article is directly talking about. It's actually looking at how literacy changes the brain of grown adults. Now, the reason this is such an interesting and novel experiment is that in most modern day societies, we have such a high literacy rate that it's hard to go out and find a bunch of people who can't read and then teach them to read in a controlled setting, especially people who really can't read at all. People we consider non-literate in most Western modern day societies are just those who have trouble reading, but can still probably read a little bit.
Every non-literate person in America personally is tutored and learned how to be to an acceptable level of reading by LeVar Burton himself.
That is true.
The more you know.
The whole thing is we do have like these little things in modern day society where if you don't know what a stop sign means, you know, you can't read stop or you can't read little tiny things. It's very hard to get by. So even those we don't consider super literate do have some amount of literacy to them. In this case, these researchers went to a rural part of India, a place where there was already a low literacy rate of about 39%, especially true for women in that area because they got smart. They didn't want their women reading. Am I right, Damien?
No, I don't know. See, as a male feminist, I'm actually shocked that you would even look to me and make that joke.
I'd ask Naomi, but there's no way she could read the answer.
Let's shun him. Can we make a podcast, just a science podcast? I'll handle dick jokes and vagina jokes. You handle all the
and
science.
You know, we'll take all the dinosaurs as well.
Oh, God damn it. All right. So they went to this rural part of India where they had a lot of women who were never taught to read, couldn't read at all, literally couldn't read a single word. And then they put them through this six-month training course where they trained them to read and eventually got them to basically the literacy rate of about what we would consider a first grader here in Western nations.
Was the problem was that they were showing them English words and they just couldn't read.
I have no idea what this even means.
She has no idea what a stop sign is. How stupid is this lady?
What an illiterate idiot. Yeah, they were actually university professors. They just only spoke Hindi. But what they did is they took brain scans before and after this process to see what changed in these people's brains over the course of time, and they found some really interesting stuff. Now, the reason this is interesting, again, is if we did these studies in modern-day societies, you could say, well, why can't we do it on children and then do it as they learn how to read? Well, there's also growing parts of a child's brain, so it's confounding factors. We wouldn't be able to separate what is actually being changed by literacy and what's being changed by natural brain growth.
Well, if you were to intentionally make a child illiterate and not educated.
Control group.
Yeah, and not just one, but enough children.
We'll get that group from the South.
Well, I mean, homeschooling. I mean, you can't tell me every homeschooled kid knows how to fucking read.
That's true. So what they did is they actually looked at these adults, they compared before and after, and they looked at the brain. Beforehand, we thought all of this learning happens in, you know, kind of the neocortex, these interesting parts of the brain that are very new. That's probably where all that literacy occurs, so that's where we would see the changes. What's really interesting is while those areas did change, those were not the only changes they saw in the brains of these women pre and post literacy. In contrast to those previous assumptions, the learning process leads to a reorganization that extends deep into the brain structures, things like the thalamus and the brainstem, things that are super basal, things that they have in reptiles. And the relatively young phenomenon of human writing obviously can't have an effect on the actual brain itself, except in very, very small ways evolutionarily. So what we're essentially doing when we learn to read is hacking some of the old parts of our brain that are used for very basic functions and reordering them to be used in this very modern day function.
Instead of paragraphs, it used to be facial expressions of wolves? Like
Kind of. Well, what's really interesting is they looked at different parts of the brain. There's one part called the colliculi superioris, which is a part of the brainstem, and the pulvinar, which are located in the thalamus, and they adapt the timing of their activity patterns to those of the visual cortex. So what's going on is your brain actually has to learn the process of reading, going left to right, or in the case of some languages, right to left, going back and forth, sweeping across, and then discerning the actual drawings that we call letters that are on the page from the page itself. And it uses the parts of the brain that we normally consider the parts that are used to pull out information from your visual field. Just look up with whatever you're doing right now. Look up and look around your environment. You're going to see literally millions of things if you got down and started writing it down. I see this wall. I see these pictures on this wall. I see, you know, all these tiny little writings or drawings. I see the marks. I see the hinges on the door. I see this, this, and this. If you're outside, you experience a lot of different blades of grass or leaves on a tree. Your brain has to be able to filter out what is important and what is not through that visual system. Otherwise, you'd look at an oak tree and say, oh my God, I see, you know, 4 million leaves, and each one of those leaves would be as substantial as the tree and the tiger behind it. So this part of your brain, the part that usually picks out, oh, the tiger behind it is important, is also what you need to look at a page and discern the letters from the backing, discern what those letters mean, how to organize them, and then what those things mean in terms of small little bits of audio information, what the letter A sounds like, B sounds like in the conjugations. So it's very, very interesting that we're seeing not just the super new and modern parts of the brain, but really old functions of your brain changing when you learn to read. That brings up the question, does things that we do like modern day computing, things like learning a new language, all that kind of stuff, do those also hack these weird ancient parts of the brain and teach us how to use them in different ways?
I don't know how many of our fans out there are like me, but I listen to my podcast when driving. And when you said look up, I think you really put a lot of the Damien audience in lives in jeopardy.
Oh, yeah. I should have specified. Don't look straight into the headliner of your vehicle.
And for how long? I mean, they're probably still look. Can we tell them to look down? Are they still?
Now we can. Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, I'm sure the car would have come to a screeching halt by now at some point. But what's also interesting is this might give some clues to dyslexia, because we think of dyslexia now as what part of the brain is affected. How is it causing them to not be able to read? It might not actually be a neocortex learning issue. It might be a part of these very basal visual functions that your eyes are not able to coordinate with other parts of your brain to follow the writing on the pages. That's why you get a disturbed version of what's coming in. And therefore, things like this, this type of brain research, might actually help us find ways to teach people who are dyslexic to learn how to read.
What's the rate of dyslexia amongst people who speak sign language?
That'd be interesting. Yeah, would you just always think people are flipping you off?
As someone who was previously homeschooled and some of my
that's why you can't read
formative years, I really take a lot of interest into the study for a couple of reasons. One, it's really interesting to see a study that targets a group of people who are typically marginalized in this particular area.
Yeah.
And to not only learn from it, but also to help support them and to make them stronger and to give them a better chance where they live. We have a lot of interventions that are designed, public health interventions and initiatives that are designed to help groups of marginalized people in this type of way by empowering women and giving them more rights. So to me, as a woman, mm-hmm. and to one who lost out on education experiences and opportunities when I was younger, I see this as being really, really huge.
Yeah. And as a man, I will take the downsides of allowing women to read with the good sides of figuring out about the brain.
I write a lot of funny jokes on bathroom walls, and they're going to be wasted on half the population if they can't read. I would have liked to have seen what learning sign language did to Coco the gorilla.
Yeah, see what parts of the brain it changed. Like, you know, I know that's supposed to be a joke, but I actually think that's probably a pretty interesting study.
Wait, because I said it as a joke?
I would believe so, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Of,
you're right, he is.
That's absolutely true. I'd like to see where this goes in the future. I'd like to see them try this on a bunch of different types of people. Like I said, what would the difference be if you had somebody who, even though they were illiterate, you were able to be able to, through other diagnostic tests, show that they are dyslexic? Then you don't go through the reading process and see how this changes and see if maybe it is that difference. Maybe you look at people who are dyslexic, look at some brain scans, and see if they have problems between these two regions of the brain that we hadn't even been looking for before in dyslexic people because we didn't think it was part of reading. And maybe if we can figure out how to change that or how to alter that or how to train around it, this could be the start of new treatment for things like dyslexia.
I think we could access this group of people if we were to offer amnesty to anybody with an Attic family. If you just let us study your Attic family and their literacy.
You think there's a lot of people keeping hidden Attic families?
Is there anything like my dad? Yeah.
Yeah, this isn't Germany, dude.
I thought you were saying addict families. Like everyone in the family is addicted to something.
No, Attic family. Although I could see, no, I'm not going to make a crass drug addict joke. No, I'm talking about having a family enslaved in a fucking attic. Wasn't there, there was a movie and book, Flowers in the Attic.
I'm sorry, I can't read, so I don't know. All right, let's move right on to the Miss Reports.
The Miss Reports, where we tell you how wrong you are.
From one form of brain damage to another, this week in the Miss Reports, does brain damage cause religious fundamentalism? This article's been floating around. I've got this specific version of it off IFL Science. There's a popular science article that seems to claim that brain damage is responsible for certain types of fundamental religious beliefs.
That sounds, I mean, somebody with a TBI is more likely to be an evangelist than, let's say, a Harvard professor.
Right. Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, that's true. It's probably correlational, maybe more than causational. But it's not necessarily what this study says. It's just that certain damage can make certain opinions or beliefs hard to change, which might include religious fundamentalism. But here's some of the things you have to know about the study. First of all, they did it on veterans who had some kind of traumatic brain injury. They looked at them and they saw whether or not the traumatic brain injury hit certain parts of the brain that help aid to cognitive flexibility. And we said, well, if when we see damage to these parts of the brain, we see a correlation with really high fundamentalist beliefs and the inability to change those beliefs. Well, let's take a few things. One is you already have a narrow sample size. You're already looking at people in the military who are getting blown up. That is already not a broad spectrum of the general population.
They're also much more, there are much more evangelicals in the military
right. than
there would be on a college campus. And very few people go to college to kill a Muslim.
And there were only 119, really, out of,
yes.
when you're looking at military vets, really, that's a, you know, that's not a very large sample size.
And what were their jobs? Are they, an infantry soldier is going to be smarter than a guy who works with computers.
Right. Well, that's my point, too, is, you know, who's more likely to get blown up in one of these things? It's usually somebody who's in the infantry or who's out in the shit, you know, as opposed to the guy who took the job doing the advanced technical stuff, right? So you've already narrowed that down to somebody who also might have a religious preference, like you said. You know, maybe they joined up in the military because of a religious preference and took that job in the military because of a religious preference, and then that translates over. So first of all, we got to throw out the assumption that this is any kind of broad spectrum population look. It's not. You are only looking at this very narrow slice of the population. Second of all, think of afterwards. The causation correlation doesn't end there with the selection pressure. Look at it afterwards. You get blown up in something and you survive, you might be much more likely to hold on to a fundamental religious belief than your average person who hasn't had that experience. Because you're like, oh my God, I had these existing religious beliefs and then I got blown up. Now I'm still alive. Man, I'm going to really cling to this religious belief.
Praise Allah.
Exactly.
I had a couple of other things I thought were really interesting about this. You know, we looked at it. It's a narrow slice of the population.
Right.
But given the period of time and even comparing it to today's military, I mean, what does the drug use look like?
Yeah.
You know, both prior to and then after. So we know that there are some issues with fundamentalism as a potential manifestation of certain types of addictions. So maybe
right.
you don't have a drug issue, but you find that high or that addiction with religion. And also, what about their levels of education? So generally speaking, I think you find people that are more on the higher end of education maybe tend to not be so fundamentalist in thinking.
In the Army, I had a high school diploma and I was called college boy.
Like, wow.
In a pejorative, I'd like to add. But also, a lot of these guys enlist from more rural communities. Even
right.
if they didn't have religious
exactly.
beliefs, they're going to go back to that rural community where it is preferred that you are a Satanist to an atheist. So
right.
you might just lie and say, yeah, I'm a Christian, and even if you didn't believe it.
And it gets reinforced. We've talked before about how things like both religious and political preference have a lot to do with your social structure around you. So if you go back to these rural communities, or veterans groups can be this way too, a lot of that can be a reinforcing stereotype of fundamentalist religious beliefs. And so these are all correlational, causational issues that cannot be worked out in this data. So when you see those headlines, brain damage linked to religious fundamentalism, one, it's not the truth. But two, it's not doing any justice to this research or to the researchers themselves, because I guarantee you they're not the ones who wrote that title. That was some science writer's editor at some point.
Picturing Bobby yelling at the scientists. They're religious because they're dumb, not because of their some job they had in their fucking 20s.
Not because of the brain damage.
Because they're fucking dumb.
What would be more valuable is to have, when everyone's signing up initially mm-hmm. and they have to go undergo their medical history and all their checkups and their vaccinations, things that they can't say no to, right? You have to say yes to everything. What if they had everyone had a brain scan done prior to, and then do a baseline and then compare it later?
Yeah.
That would be more telling. And or, maybe a better direction for us.
Or
like
even
this.
You get rid of the military component altogether, because that's already going to slice you up in a weird N number type of way. And you say, okay, let's look at religious fundamentalists. Let's look at people who aren't religiously fundamental. And then let's look at some control population that's a mixture of both. Now let's look at the correlational issues between certain brain scans and see if we can find something there. Because at least then, if you're looking at a broader swath, you're actually analyzing fundamentalists versus non-fundamentalists, as opposed to people in the military who had certain brain trauma.
They should have done, instead of military, like X Games athletes, people who aren't prone.
Right.
Like after this traumatic brain injury.
That's true. There is a lot of brain injury. There are NFL players. Now, NFL players are pretty religious, actually. Yeah.
Ivy League NFL. Ivy League football players. You take the Harvard football team.
Okay? It's just Fitzgerald from the Jets. Very, very interesting stuff. Let's move right on to science fighters.
Science fighters and science fighters. Which side are you on? It's a little confusing, I know. It's a double entendre. You know what? Just listen. You'll like it.
All right. From defending religious fundamentalists to going back to our age-old tradition of fighting them, this week's science fighter, surprisingly, a geologist. Care to take a guess, Damien?
No, because this is another biased thing against me. I'm not guessing.
Wrong again, Damien. As always, you are incorrect. This is a science fighter in that he is fighting science.
You're never going to get that smiley face sticker.
Yeah, this is in fact a quote-unquote geologist. Now, I must say, I did some research into this guy. His name is Andrew Snelling. He's not, I mean, he has a geology degree and he has published in geological circles, but he's not really a geologist in that he doesn't conform to the principles of actual geology, vis-a-vis he's a young Earth creationist, and he has done a bunch of stuff and said a bunch of stuff that aren't really fitting with somebody who is actually a geologist.
You mean everybody in the scientific community?
Right, yeah.
Why isn't the chief geologist in charge of him not taking his badge and gun?
Yeah, well, he's only 3 days away from retirement. And
he saved the mayor once.
Yeah, I mean, like, he was investigating a gem smuggling ring. but basically, this geologist, he is a creationist, and he's suing the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, I'd like to see that lawsuit. It just says across the top, like, Andrew Snelling versus the Grand Canyon.
Well, I mean, but in his mind, who created the Grand Canyon?
That's
right?
True.
So he's suing his creator?
He must be. He's Judas.
Who owns the Grand Canyon? It's us. So he's suing all of our listeners.
That's
minus
right.
International listeners.
He thinks he can prove that the Earth is real young. The Grand Canyon is a big flashpoint for creationists because it's hard to explain this massive thing on a short time scale. A lot of times they try and use the flood in order to do it and stuff. It's obviously it's a river that's been cutting through something. And by the way, Grand Canyon isn't even that old. It's just cutting through very soft rock. It's only like a few million years old. It's not hugely old in geological timescales. But the creationists obviously hate it for that reason.
Kind of seems like a catch-22, doesn't it, though? Like, the level of critical thought it takes to look at the Grand Canyon and try to justify it by creationist means. I feel like a smart person put this idea in their head.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it might be something like along those lines. He wants to collect rock samples to try and prove his theory. I don't know how he's going to prove it. I don't know what he's going to do to try and prove that the Grand Canyon itself is young, but he would like to do that. Now, here's the thing. It's run by the National Park Service. There's also native tribes in there who have a vested interest because that's their traditional cultural landscape. And it is hard to get permits to collect stuff from places like that. As somebody who has to get permits to collect archaeological resources, it's a big deal, and it's really difficult to do. And most of the time, unless you have the approval of A, the tribes, but then B, also the governing bodies and certain scientists doing research and stuff, you're not going to get that approval. So you're going to get shot down most of the time when you're doing legitimate scientific investigation. And unsurprisingly, he's not. He got shot down. And so now he's getting mad and he's suing, I believe, the National Park Service as well as some of the guardians of the Grand Canyon for not letting him come in and take these rocks to prove that the Earth is 5,000 years old.
I speak on behalf of all Native Americans and that we have
don't.
A vested interest in hiding that the Earth is only 6,000 years old.
What is your interest in that?
Maize.
God, stop that. That is the worst answer.
So who exactly is going to test these samples? Should he be allowed to
right.
have a 60 sample?
And what type of tests would they do? You know, and it would be great if he had some machine and it was just like a rock grinder and you throw rocks in there, it grinds it up a bunch, and then there's an iPad hooked up to it, and after it's done, it goes like processing, and then it just pops up, Jesus!
There's an app for that.
And he's like, thank God for my brain damage!
I feel like that'd be a Windows product.
Very, very interesting stuff, but it proves again, it's not all conspiracies. They have legitimate reasons for keeping people from doing quote unquote research who are either A, not qualified, or B, just don't have the right stuff set up for them to be able to pull off whatever they're trying to do. So, like, even if you're doing legitimate scientific research, a lot of times you won't get permission to collect the samples you want. That's the way of things. In this case, he's not doing legitimate research, and there's no reason to damage a national landmark / cultural area for bullshit. And so I actually stand behind the National Park Service. A lot of people online are like, hey, just let him do it. Why not? Fuck that. Fuck him. We don't need to prove that. If he wants to go prove his ideas, go to one of the many other places anywhere on Earth that you can go, because if the whole Earth is 5,000 years old, go someplace else.
The Mediocre Canyon is in Idaho. Go yeah. check that one out.
I'm torn on this one, because on one side, if he's got a lot of funding on the fundamentalist side,
right.
Then let him. I mean, sometimes it takes us a long time to get funding for certain projects, and we have who knows what kinds of other beneficial things we may learn from it. And there's no way it's going to be able to disprove everything.
No, he can't. I mean, it's more along the lines of anything you do in that sense is destructive. It's the same thing with archaeology, but your investigation is necessarily destructive. So you try and limit the amount of investigations that happen to necessary ones. And this is most certainly isn't necessary. But also, again, if he's trying to prove this, go anywhere else. Go to a place that isn't culturally sensitive, where you don't have native tribes who have this as their traditional cultural landscape.
Or a massive gorge in some other place that has...
When you said, like, go to a place that isn't culturally sensitive, I pictured, like, Dallas, Texas. Well, you're going to take a core sample here in the middle of Texas.
Take 10.
Yeah. You sure you don't want... Does this machine run on Muslim blood? Because we can get you some.
I still think that he should be allowed to do this, but I think there should be a condition. He should be conditionally allowed to do this on the premise that he should have to go undergo a brain scan prior to, and that, you know, we'll see what kind of, if he can further the study that we talked about previously.
Well, here's my thing. I would acquiesce to what you're saying, because even though it is destructive, if he followed this particular protocol, when you do proper science, you don't just collect samples and then test them how you want to, which is what he would like to do. You first write out your entire process. Here's what I'm going to do once I get the samples. Here are the tests I'm going to conduct. If I get this answer, it will mean this. If I get this answer, it will mean that. If he did all of that and it got reviewed by actual geologists who said, yes, this would be a good test to tell if these rocks are 4 billion years old or 5,000 years old, and if he does them this way, he will say yes or no. And then he has to publish the results, because we already know what those results are going to be.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So if you force him to do actual science and then publicly declare what he found, then I'm all for it, because it adds to the scientific knowledge.
What type of test is he doing?
We don't know, because he's not doing that process. He just says, I want to collect the samples and do tests.
Oh, he hasn't discussed what kind of tests he wants to do?
No.
I'm going to read a statement from his lawyer. He says he's planning on just skipping a bunch of rocks, and if it skips less than 10 times, it must be less than 6,000 years old.
It's going to be a scratch test and a hardness test.
Yeah. All right, everybody, let's move right on to I Call BS.
I call
BS.
All right, this is I Call BS, where I give my panelists 4 science news articles, and they compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
Wait, is this bad science or is this bad science?
You have to understand, she put on sunglasses, she flipped up the collar of her leather jacket when she said that.
Yeah.
Podcast and audio medium.
She basically became Arthur Fonzarelli in front of our very eyes.
The best part was she lit a cigarette. I didn't see where she lit the match from.
Come on. Madhouse is smoke-free environment in here.
She's too cool, Bobby.
All right. Let's start with article number 1. Researchers digging underneath an ancient Peruvian pyramid found even more ancient artifacts buried 100 feet below it and dating to 15,000 years ago. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science, because Bobby would have a 15,000 kilometer erection if this story was true.
I like that you went kilometers. Metric. Way to go. Really good. Bring the scientists out in you.
I've been watching a lot of BBC recently.
Yeah, but it's different what you're watching. It's still called BBC, but the acronym means something completely different.
He had 1/4 of a meter cock. I had to look up what that meant. They don't have feet in fucking metric.
Thankfully, the word black is the same in English. All right, and of course, Naomi.
Oh, he drives a really strong argument on that one. I'm going to say science. I think that maybe they had some historical knowledge. Maybe it was a sacred site from something else. They just didn't have all the details yet.
All right, going on to article number 2. A 100-year-old drug used to treat infections by African parasites has shown the reversal of autism spectrum disorder in humans. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This sounds too good to be true. Reduction in autism, and it doesn't mess with vaccines. You know what? I'm gullible. I'm going to say that's science.
And Naomi.
This sounds way too complicated and way more expensive than that chlorine treatment we talked about a couple of months ago. So I'm going to say bad science. I think maybe it's useful for something, but not autism.
All right. Article number 3. New research confirms that humans and chimps split from a common ancestor in Eastern Europe, not in Africa, as previously thought. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. Everything reaches Eastern Europe later, not before.
That's true. They're just getting cassette tapes.
No way they got fucking evolution before us.
And Naomi.
I'm going to go bad science.
All right. Article number 4. New research suggests opiate use is unlikely to lead to addiction if only used in the short term. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This sounds like bad science. This sounds like how doctors who work for Philip Morris used to say tobacco was safe around babies. And
right.
Stuff.
No, actually, one of my favorite doctor interviews is when they're talking and they're like, did you know that tobacco smoke is really, really highly associated with low birth weight? And the doctor was like,
a lot of pregnant women might want smaller babies.
There are probably a certain percentage of narrow canaled but wide children having people out there who probably were grateful for Marlboro Man.
It's practically medicine. And Naomi.
If only it weren't for all the other things that that's related to.
Right. Like looking awesome.
There's not enough information for this question. You know, opiates don't cause addiction. Who's saying this? And define short term. Short term by the addict? Oh, I'm only using just for a little bit, just for a couple of days. I'm going to go science.
All right. Let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you guys did. Article number one. Researchers digging underneath an ancient Peruvian pyramid found even more ancient artifacts buried 100 feet below it and dating to 15,000 years ago. Damien thinks this is bad science. Naomi thinks this is science. And this one is science.
What?
And a very, very cool story.
So wait, the very first time there's an archaeology article and you decide not to fucking run with it?
That's true.
That's what I was thinking as well.
You intentionally fucked me on this. You changed the whole format of the show just to get me on this one question.
Yeah, and I will continue to do so. This is a fantastically interesting article. The archaeologist was working at the site. The archaeologist is actually Tom Dillahay, who you may remember me mentioning earlier when we talked about that whole Macedon thing as one of the legitimate, very, very old Western Hemisphere New World archaeologist who does legitimate work in really old sites. This was one of them. They were looking at an ancient Peruvian pyramid, I would say it's very a generous term in this case. It's really a mud mound, but it is a archaeological cultural feature. And they were looking underneath it and they dug down and they went, okay, great. We got everything out of this pyramid. Fantastic. Pyramid was a few thousand years old. This looks great. And then the geologist was like, hey, we want to see what is underlying this thing. We want to see the geological strata underneath. So they kept going. They went down 100 feet. And to their surprise, they found a bunch of artifacts, including textiles and woven basketry. Very, very cool stuff.
5 feet further down, ancient aliens.
That's right. And in this, they were able to get great C14 dates because they had organic material. They found stuff at 15,000 years old, which puts it in this very, very narrow elite group of sites of more than 15,000 year old sites in the Americas. Incredibly interesting because, like Naomi brought up, it is essentially they built this mound thousands of years later over the occupation area of a group that was there a long, long time ago. And in fact, we are probably much closer to the people who built this pyramid mound thing than they were to the very, very early people who were there 100 feet deeper. Now, that type of sedimentation is not normal. It's not normal over the course of, let's say, 10,000 years to get 100 foot of sedimentation. But in certain areas, that can happen with certain kind of depositional layers. It is rare, which is why most of the time you're not doing archaeology at 100 feet deep, regardless of where you are on the earth. But in this particular case, they did find it. It probably makes it the deepest site in all of North and South America. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I believe that is around deeper than anything I have heard of, at least. Very, very interesting stuff. It'll be interesting to go back and see other things that we find in this area that might be down that far or might be that old. It really speaks again to that original occupation of the Americas. We know that happened somewhere between 25,000 to 17,000 years ago.
If dull and boring was a martial art, you have Anderson Silva mercilessly pummeled our audience countless times with archaeology articles that are 1/4 as interesting as this one.
Thank you, Damien, for pointing out how interesting this article is. That's all I got out of your comments. Article number two. A 100-year-old drug used to treat infection by African parasites has shown the reversal of autism spectrum disorder in humans. Damien thinks this is true. Naomi thinks this one's false. And this one is science, though a super, super small study with an N number, activation N number of 5. So don't take this as some kind of broad study. This is actually an experimental design study that's basically a proof of concept.
Was the small referring to the stature of the people or small?
Yeah, they only used, actually kind of, because they only used kids. So.
Oh, okay.
So this drug is called Suramin. It's been used to treat things like sleeping sickness from an African parasite for over 100 years. The reason that's really important is the patent is now expired on this medicine.
Oh,
so it's essentially nobody owns it. You can't say, oh, this is big pharma. Nobody owns this anymore. This is public domain. Now, they had used this drug before in mice that had been genetically engineered to display autistic spectrum disorder, and they saw this huge increase in abilities and skills that seemed to put them outside of the spectrum disorder. We actually discussed this on a previous Science Faction.
Also, a huge increase in mice found at blackjack tables.
No, that was beforehand. Before. This got brought them away from the blackjack table. This particular drug has been given to so many people over the years that its side effects are also super well known, which is really nice. In the large doses needed to treat sleep sickness, the side effects can be super severe, so it's not recommended that parents who have kids with autism just go out and find this old drug and start giving it to their kids, because we got to make sure we get the dosages right and we properly treat and control for other things, because there are side effects to this drug. But the good news is it's kind of like FDA testing has already been done. There's no whole patent holder on this particular drug. We know how to make it. We know what the effects are. All of that is fantastic when you're looking at trying to introduce this to a new population.
So who funded the study?
Good question. So the funding limitations is what forced this to start in such a small amount with just five boys aged 5 to 14, because there's nobody who's giving a lot of money to this. So this is a guy who's going out and getting his own grants based on previous research. One of the reasons that he's actually, I think he's now crowdfunding the next study to go on. It's really, really interesting because these gains were not small at all. That's what's really interesting. We saw huge gains in the mice studies. We talked on Science Faction how we wanted to see what happens when they start doing human trials. Let me just read you some of the things. The parents of a 14-year-old boy who had not spoken a complete sentence in 12 years said in a statement, within an hour after the infusion, he started to make eye contact with the doctor and nurses in the room, and then they saw him advance almost 3 years in development in just 6 weeks. Two previously nonverbal children, given the Suramin, spoke their first sentences within a week. All of them maintained higher levels of eye contact and personal interaction. This is a very small study with just a few intravenous injections of this drug. So we're not talking about long-term. Now, some of them kept some of the gains over time, but most of the major gains left after the study went away. So they got some long-term benefits, but a lot of huge short-term benefits, which might make it not necessarily a cure, but more of a treatment that somebody could do long-term. Very interesting for all those people suffering from autism spectrum disorder.
One, how do they diagnose autism in Africa? They must not have the same diagnosis system we have here. And two, I didn't even know there were vaccines in Africa, let alone where are they shipping in the autism?
This was done here. They just had the sleeping sickness in Africa 100 years ago. It has nothing to do with Africa now.
And there were no girls in the study.
No. And that is kind of typical because, as we know, there's a 4-to-1 ratio sex link between males with autism to females to autism. So it makes sense that, especially in such a small study, you would start with only males.
Or it could be just the privileged male. You know, we have
Viagra, Cialis, all kinds
of things for male sexual dysfunction.
I would argue, how about this? It's the privileged female because we don't want to test experimental shit on them.
Temple Grandin was the first person to break the autism glass ceiling. And now there are much more professional women in autism fields.
All the boys who got the infusion showed significant changes, better language and coping skills, and social behavior, with some more similar to neurotypical children of the same age. We're basically, in this small study, and again, it should be noted, we need much bigger studies to make much bigger claims. We also need much more long-term studies to see how this affects things long-term. But in the short term, in this incredibly tiny sample size, this is so promising for this otherwise devastating disease. All right, let's move on to article number 3. New research confirms that humans and chimps split from a common ancestor in Eastern Europe, not in Africa, as previously thought. Damien thought this was false. Naomi also thought this one was false, and this one is bad science. Good job, guys. Though you wouldn't know it from reading the article headlines about this, it all hinges on the fossils of an ancient ape known from two separate fossil teeth and partial jaws discovered in the Balkans. The researchers are arguing that the morphology of these teeth show that chimps and humans had already split in Europe some 7.2 million years ago, which is before the current genetic evidence shows a split. They're finding these ape teeth, and basically the difference between us and some of our closest chimp relatives in terms of teeth, a lot have to do with the roots and the root structures and the way they work. What they're saying is these root structures seem to imply that this split happened a long time ago and happened in Eastern Europe where we're finding these fossils. Here's the problem with this. Number one, they're not accounting for convergent evolution, meaning that let's say you have these apes in Eastern Europe and you have apes in Africa where we know we evolved. I mean, basically, we have so much solid evidence that the human beings evolved in Eastern Africa. So let's say as we see the human lineage come, we see this differentiation in the tooth roots. That same differentiation can happen in another species in Eastern Europe. It's what we call convergent evolution. It's the reason Tasmanian tigers look like wolves, you know, the completely different lineages, but they kind of get to the same body type. We can have that convergent evolution appear, and that is way more likely based on the genetic and fossil evidence than somehow human beings evolving in Eastern Europe from chimps and then both groups migrating back to Eastern Africa where we have the fossils and continuing to live there.
I'm surprised you didn't get into it more, but one interesting fact from this article that I found was the way they tell the difference between a chimp tooth and a human tooth is that the human tooth has an opposable thumb and a large penis.
That's not at all it. And chimps have opposable thumbs.
The chimp tooth loves bananas.
Wait, I'm reading something else. It says, I bite my thumb at you. It's from a chimp.
Should have taught that fucking chimp to read.
All right. Article number 4. New research suggests opiate use is unlikely to lead to addiction if only used in the short term. Damien thinks this is false. Naomi thinks this is true. And this one is bad science. Congratulations, Damien, for the win.
I was considering abstaining just because this game is a civil rights huge civil rights violation in San Diego.
How dare you?
But I'm glad I pulled out a victory. It's unlikely.
Yeah, it is. Game, it's almost certainly by guessing. All right. Well, even though this is a really interesting study, they basically had to look at opiate prescriptions that were completely unnecessary. That was part of their thing. So they don't want to do is start seeing people continuously use opiates because of some kind of damage that turns out they actually did need opiates for. So they picked an injury that people get opiate prescriptions for that is completely not necessary and no medical professional agrees that you should. This time they chose sprained ankles. What's really crazy is about 7% of patients that go to the hospital with a sprained ankle leave with a prescription for some kind of opiate, Vicodin, OxyContin, Percocet, something like that.
What's the most effective way to sprain one's ankle without long-term damage?
Yeah, there isn't long-term damage. It's a fucking sprained ankle.
Quick, sprain my ankle real fast.
Well, I don't want to have you like run over my ankle with your car when that would have been way too much.
Something one of the researchers pointed out is not only is there no reason to do that because it's just an inflammatory thing, you should have ibuprofen to get the blood flowing and stuff. It is actually counterproductive because you're supposed to stay off that ankle and not do extended damage. And if you take painkillers, you're less likely to feel the pain and you're more likely to do something that will cause more damage to it. It's crazy, but we in America love prescribing opiates. It's one of the reasons we have a huge heroin epidemic, because people get addicted to opiates that are prescribed legally from the hospital and then they can't afford it anymore and then they end up switching to heroin.
Do doctors get a portion of the profits whenever they prescribe an opioid?
Kind of. The drug companies do incentivize them with things like trips to Hawaii and things like that in order to try and show, hey, look, this is our new drug. But in reality, those trips and those things a lot of times are geared towards the doctors who prescribe it the most. And they get, you know, expensive dinners. They get rewarded in certain ways. And so we have this really fucked up system of rewarding people for essentially being heroin dealers.
I still want to know, how do they define short term? Define short term.
Right.
And the reason I ask is because a lot of addictions with opiates tend to arise from fairly minor dental procedures. And that only requires like 3 to 4 days of use. And then after those 3 to 4 days, you already start experiencing some physiological side effects of stopping.
Yeah. And I think in this case, they were looking at about a week or less, so around that same time. And what they were looking at is, do these people come back and continue to try and refill or overfill these prescriptions afterwards? And they found that a significant portion did, even with these short-term usage. The reason this is important is because a lot of these companies, especially the large manufacturers of things like Vicodin and OxyContin, they argue that short-term opiate use does not and cannot lead to addiction. That is completely false. And the more studies that they put out like this that show, no, actually people we give just a week's supply to continually come in and try and refill these prescriptions. They try and get their 30 prescription up to 60. They try and go more and more. And what's even sadder, a lot of times they get it done. They actually get these, especially in places with pain management clinics, they can get these prescriptions continually filled and continually get these opiate medications. Even these short-term things, these things we think might be safe. Here is a week's supply of this drug, and it's a great sample to use because it's a group of people with a sprained ankle who have no business having the opiates in the first place, much less 2 weeks supplies. Let's look at them and see what happens over time. You can prove that even this 1 week supply of opiates is enough to get people addicted.
How's that ankle there, Bob? Oh, it's rough, man. Back in Nam, I sprained it and just, you know, still getting those opioids.
It's crazy too, because some of them found some prescriptions were like 5 pills. Some were for 60. Somebody got 60 OxyContins because they sprained their ankle.
People build up resistances and then still keep spraining their ankles.
You also have to wonder how much of this might be actually addiction-seeking behavior. So a lot of times people who are addicts will hurt themselves specifically to go to the hospital and get prescription opiates.
If I were Pfizer or one of these drug companies, I would lean into this.
They have been, actually.
I wouldn't find the doctors who lie and falsify data. I would lean into this and say, hey, our products took down Rush Limbaugh. Without our products, Rush Limbaugh would still be on the air. How do we know that we didn't kill Roger Ailes?
Very good. Congratulations, Damien, on your first ever win of I Call BS.
First ever.
That's the first one I remember. First
ever. You
are the Andrew fucking Wakefield of this show.
I don't think I remember you ever winning before. Thank you, Naomi, for coming out to visit us. And thank you, audience, for coming back to Science Faction 176, where you learned about the Cambrian period, how literacy changes your brain, why religious fundamentalism isn't necessarily caused by brain damage, why a science fighter is suing the Grand Canyon, how we found 15,000-year-old artifacts 100 feet below a Peruvian pyramid, how a 100-year-old African sleeping sickness drug might be the cure to autism, how humans and chimps didn't split apart in Europe, and how even small doses of opiates can cause long-term addiction. Thank you so much for joining us, and please come on back next week for Science Faction 177.
Humans and chimps may not have split apart in Eastern Europe, but if I'm allowed to continue my research, that's where they'll get back together.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.